here to bring emotion under control, but I needed more time to discover that. That torrent of color had to rest. That would be a job for tomorrow and beyond, when I could return to it under a fresh, bright light. The passage of the right amount of time would show me what was needed. I had to wait for it, like waiting patiently for the phone to ring. And in order to wait that patiently, I had to put my faith in time. I had to believe that time was on my side. Seated on the stool, I shut my eyes and took a deep breath. In the autumn twilight, I could clearly sense something within me changing, as if the structure of my body had unraveled, then was being recombined in a different way. But why here? And why now? Did meeting the enigmatic Manshiki and taking on his portrait commission result in this sort of internal transformation? Or had uncovering the weird underground chamber and being led there by the sound of the bell acted as a stimulus to my spirit? Or was it that I'd merely reached an unrelated turning point in my life? No matter which explanation I went with, there didn't seem to be any basis for it. "It feels like this is just the beginning," Manshiki had said as we parted. Had I stepped into this beginning he'd spoken about? At any rate, I'd been so worked up by the act of painting in a way I hadn't in years, so absorbed in creating, that I'd literally forgotten the passage of time. As I stowed away my materials, my skin had a feverish flush that felt good. As I straightened up, the bell on the shelf caught my eye. I picked it up and tried ringing it a couple of times. The familiar sound rang out clearly in the studio. The middle of the night sound that made me anxious. Somehow, though, it didn't frighten me anymore. I merely wondered why such an ancient bell could still make such a clear sound. I put the bell back where it had been, switched off the light, and shut the door to the studio. Back in the kitchen, I poured myself a glass of white wine, and sipped it as I prepared dinner. Just before 9 p.m., a call came in from Manshiki.
"How were things last night?" he asked. "Did you hear the bell?"
I'd stayed up until 2:30, but hadn't heard the bell at all, I told him. It was a very quiet night.
"Glad to hear it. Since then, has anything unusual happened around you?"
"Nothing particularly unusual, no," I replied.
"That's good. I hope it continues that way," Manshiki said.
A moment later, he added, "Would it be all right for me to stop by tomorrow morning? I'd really like to take another good look at the stone chamber if I could. It's a fascinating place." "Fine by me," I said. "I have no plans for tomorrow morning."
"Then I'll see you around 11.
"Looking forward to it," I said.
"By the way, was today a good day for you?" Manshiki asked.
Was today a good day for me? It sounded like a sentence that had been translated mechanically by computer software. "A relatively good day," I replied, puzzled for a moment. "At least nothing bad happened. The weather was good. Overall, a pleasant day. What about you, Mr. Manshiki? Was today a good day for you?"
"It was a day when one good thing happened, and so did one not-so-good thing," Manshiki replied. "The scale is still swinging, unable to decide which one was heavier, the good or the bad."
I didn't know how to respond to that, so I stayed silent. Manshiki went on.
"Sadly, I'm not an artist like you. I live in the business world, the information business in particular. In that world, the only information that has exchange value is that which can be quantified. So I have the habit of always quantifying the good and the bad. If the good outweighs the bad even by a little, that means it's a good day, even if something bad happened, at least numerically. I still had no idea what he was getting at, so I kept my mouth closed. By unearthing that underground chamber like we did yesterday, we must have lost something and gained something. What did we lose, and what did we gain? That's what concerns me. He seemed to be waiting for me to reply. I don't think we gained anything you could quantify, I said after giving it some thought. At least right now. The only thing we got was that old Buddhist bell. But that probably doesn't have any actual value. It doesn't have any provenance and isn't some unique antique. On the other hand, what was lost can be clearly quantified. Before long, you'll be getting a bill from the landscaper, I imagine. Menshiki chuckled. It's not that expensive. Don't worry about it. What concerns me is that we haven't yet taken from there the thing we need to take. The thing we need to take? What's that? Menshiki cleared his throat. As I said, I'm no artist. I have a certain amount of intuition, but unfortunately, I don't have the means to make it concrete. No matter how keen that intuition might be, I still can't turn it into art. I don't have the talent. I was silent, waiting for what came next. Which is why I've always pursued quantification as a substitute for an artistic, universal representation. In order to live properly, people need a central axis. Don't you think so? In my case, by quantifying intuition or something like intuition through a unique system, I've been able to enjoy a degree of worldly success. And according to my intuition, he said, and was silent for a time, a very dense silence. According to my intuition, we should have got hold of something from digging up that underground chamber. Like what? He shook his head, or at least it seemed that way to me from the other end of the phone line. I still don't know. But I think we have to know. We need to combine our intuition, allow it to pass through your ability to express things in concrete form, and my ability to quantify them. I still couldn't really grasp what he was getting at. What was this man talking about? Let's see each other again tomorrow at 11, Menshiki said, and quietly hung up. Soon after he'd hung up, I got a call from my married girlfriend. I was a little surprised. It wasn't often that she'd get in touch at this time of night. Can I see you tomorrow around noon? She asked. I'm sorry, but I have an appointment tomorrow. I made it just a little while ago. Not another woman, I hope? No, it's with Mr. Menshiki. I'm painting his portrait. You're painting his portrait, she repeated. Then the day after tomorrow? The day after tomorrow's totally free. Great, is early afternoon okay? Of course, but it's Saturday. I'll manage it. Did something happen? I asked. Why do you ask? She said. You don't often call me at this time of day. She made a small sound at the back of her throat, as if making a minor adjustment in her breathing. I'm in my car now by myself. I'm calling from my cell. What are you doing in the car all alone? I just wanted to be by myself in the car, so that's where I am. Housewives sometimes do these things. Is that a problem? No problem. No problem at all. She sighed, the kind of sigh that condensed a variety of sighs into one, and then she said, I wish you were here with me. And that we could do it from behind. I don't need any foreplay. I'm so wet you could slip right inside. I want you to pound me hard and fast. Sounds good to me, but a mini is too small inside to pound you hard like that, Don't expect too much. Let's figure out a way. I want you to knead my breast with your left hand and rub my clit with your right. What should my right foot be doing? I could manage to use it to adjust the car stereo. You don't mind a little Tony Bennett? I'm not joking here. I'm totally serious. I know, my bad, serious. Got it, I said. Tell me, what are you wearing right now? You want to know what clothes I'm wearing? She asked enticingly. I do. My procedure might change depending on what you have on. Over the phone, she gave me a detailed rundown on the clothes she had on. It always surprised me, the variety of clothes mature women wore. Orally, she took these off, one by one. So, did that get you hard? She asked. Like a hammer, I said. You could pound a nail? You bet. There are hammers in the world that need to pound in nails, and nails that need to be pounded by hammers. Now who said that? Nietzsche? Or was it Schopenhauer? Or maybe nobody said it. Over the phone line, we entwined bodies in a way that felt so real. Phone sex was definitely a first for me, with her, or with anyone for that matter. Her descriptions were so detailed, so arousing, that these imaginary sex acts were, in part, more sensual than what we could do with our actual bodies. Words can sometimes be so direct, sometimes so erotically suggestive. At the end of this exchange, I unexpectedly climaxed, and she seemed to have an orgasm as well. We said nothing, catching our breath. I'll see you Saturday then, she said after she seemed to have pulled herself together. I have something to tell you about our Mr. Manshiki too. You got some new information? A bit of new information I gathered through the jungle grapevine. But I'll wait to see you to tell you, while we're probably doing something naughty. You going home now? Of course, she said. I'd better be getting back. Drive carefully. Right. I need to take care. I'm still sort of shuddering down there. I stepped into the shower and used soap to clean my penis. I changed into pajamas, threw on a cardigan, and with a glass of cheap white wine in hand, went out onto the terrace and gazed off in the direction of Manshiki's house. The lights were still on in his massive pure white mansion across the valley. The lights seemed to be on all over the house. What he was doing over there, most likely all by himself, I had no idea. Seated at the computer, perhaps, engaged once more in quantifying intuition. A relatively good day, I said to myself. And an odd day at that. What kind of day tomorrow would bring, I had no clue. Suddenly I remembered the horned owl up in the attic. Was today a good day for it too? Then I recalled that for horned owls, the day was now only beginning. During the day they slept in dark places, and come night they set out to the woods in search of prey. That was a question a horned owl should be asked early in the morning, the question of, was today a good day? I went to bed, read a book for a while, then turned off the light at 10:30 and went to sleep. Since I slept without waking even once until just before 6 the next morning, I imagine that the bell didn't ring during the middle of the night. Chapter 17. How could I miss something that important? I never could forget the last words my wife said when I left our home. Even if we break up like this, can we still be friends? If possible, I mean. At the time, and for a long time after, I couldn't understand what she was trying to say, what she was hoping for. I was confused, as if I'd put some totally tasteless food into my mouth. The best I could say was, well, who knows? and those were the last words I said to her face to face. Pretty pathetic, as final words go. Even after we broke up, it felt like my wife and I were still connected by a single living tube, an invisible tube, but one that was still beating slightly, sending something like hot blood traveling back and forth between our two souls. I still had that sort of organic sensation, but before long that tube would be severed, and if it was bound to be cut sometime, I needed to drain the life from that faint line connecting us. If the life was drained from it and it shriveled up like a mummy, the pain of it being severed by a sharp knife would be that much more bearable. To do so, I needed to forget about Yuzu as soon as I could, as much as I could. That's why I never tried to contact her. After I came back from my trip and went to pick up some belongings back at the apartment, I did call her once. I needed to get all my painting materials I'd left behind. That was the only conversation I had with Yuzu after we broke up, and it didn't last long. We officially dissolved our marriage, and I couldn't contemplate the thought of us remaining friends. We'd shared so many things during our 6 years of marriage, a lot of time, emotions, words, and silence, lots of confusion and lots of decisions, lots of promises and lots of resignation, lots of pleasure, lots of boredom. Naturally, each of us must have had inner secrets, but we even managed to find a way to share the sense of having something hidden from the other. With us, there is a gravitas of place that only the passage of time can nurture. We did a good job of accommodating our bodies to that sort of gravity, maintaining a delicate balance. We had our own special local rules that we lived by, and there was no way we could get rid of all that history, jettison the gravitational balance and local rules, and live simply as good friends. I understood that very well. That's the conclusion I came to after thinking about it during that lengthy trip. I invariably came to the same conclusion. It was best to keep Yuzu at a distance and break off contact. That made the most sense, and that's what I did. And for her part, Yuzu didn't contact me either. Not a single phone call, not one letter, even though she was the one who said she wanted to remain friends. That hurt far more than I'd expected. Or more precisely, what hurt me was actually me, myself. In the midst of that continuing, unsettled silence, my feelings, like a heavy pendulum, a razor-sharp blade, made wide swings between one extreme to the other. That arc of emotions left fresh wounds in my skin, and I had only one way of forgetting the pain, and that was, of course, by painting. Sunlight filtered in silently through the studio window. From time to time, a gentle breeze rustled the white curtains. The room had an autumn morning scent. After coming to live on the mountain, I'd grown sensitive to the changes in smells from one season to another. Back when I lived in the city, I'd hardly ever noticed those. I sat on the stool and gazed for a long time at the portrait of Menshiki I'd begun. This was the way I always began work, reevaluating with new eyes the work I'd done the previous day. Only then could I pick up my brush. Not bad, I thought. Not bad at all. The colors I'd created completely enveloped the original framework of Menshiki I'd done. The outline of him in black paint was hidden now behind those colors. Though concealed, I could still make it out. I would have to once more bring that outline into relief, transform a hint into a statement. There was no guarantee, of course, that the painting would ever be complete. It was still inchoate, something missing. Something that should be there was appealing to the non-validity of absence. and that missing element was rapping on the glass window, separating presence and absence. I could make out its wordless cry. Focusing so hard on the painting had made me thirsty, so I went into the kitchen and drank a large glass of orange juice. I relaxed my shoulders, stretched both arms high above my head, took a deep breath, and exhaled. I went back to the studio and sat down on the stool and studied the painting. Refreshed, I focused again. But something was different from before. The angle I was looking at the painting from was clearly not the same as it had been a few minutes before. I got down from the stool and checked its location. It was in a slightly different spot from when I'd left the studio earlier. The stool had clearly been moved. But how? When I'd gotten down from the stool, I hadn't moved it. That I was sure of. I'd gotten down gingerly in order not to move the stool, and when I'd come back, I'd also been careful not to move it when I sat down. I remembered these details because I'm very sensitive about the position and angle I view paintings from. I have a set position and angle that I always use, and like batters who are very particular about their stance in the batter's box, it bothers me to no end if things are off, even by a fraction. But now the stool was 18 inches away from where it had been. The angle that much changed. All I could think was that while I'd been in the kitchen drinking orange juice and taking deep breaths, someone had moved the stool. Someone had gone into the studio, sat on the stool to look at the painting, then got down from the stool before I came back, and silently slipped out of the room. And that's when, whether intentionally or it just worked out that way, they moved the stool. But I'd been out of the studio at most 5 or 6 minutes. Who in the world would go out of their way to do something like that? And why? Or had the stool moved on its own? My memory must be messed up. I'd moved the stool but forgotten that I had. That's all I could think. Maybe I was spending too much time alone. The order of events in my memory was getting muddled. I left the stool in the spot where I'd found it, in other words, a spot 20 inches away from where it had been, and at a different angle. I sat down on it and studied Menshiki's portrait from that position. What I saw was a slightly different painting. It was the same painting, of course, but it looked ever so different. The way the light struck it was not the same as before, and the texture of the paint, too, looked changed. There was something decidedly animated and alive in the painting, but also something still lacking. The direction of that lack, though, wasn't the same as before. So what was different about it? I brought my focus to bear on the painting. The difference must be speaking to me, trying to tell me something. I had to discover what was being hinted at by the difference. I took a piece of white chalk and marked the position of the three legs of the stool on the floor, location A. Then I moved the stool back 20 inches to the side to its original position, location B, and marked that, too, with chalk. I moved back and forth between the two positions, studying the one painting from the different angles. Menshiki was still in both paintings, but I noticed that his appearance was strangely different depending on the two angles. It was as if two different personalities coexisted within him. Yet both versions of Menshiki were missing something. That shared lack unified both the A and B versions of Menshiki. I had to discover what it was, as if it were triangulated between position A, position B, and myself. What could that shared absence be? Was it something that had form, or something formless? If the latter, then how was I to give it form? Not an easy thing to do, now is it? Someone said. I clearly heard that voice. Not a loud voice, but one that carried. Nothing vague about it, not high, not low, and it sounded like it was right next to my ear. I involuntarily gulped and, still seated on the stool, slowly gazed around me. I couldn't see anyone else there, of course. The clear morning light filled the floor like pools of water. The window was open, and from far off I could faintly hear the melody played by a garbage truck. It was playing Annie Laurie. Why the garbage trucks and Odawara played a Scottish folk song was a mystery to me. Beyond that, I couldn't hear a thing. Maybe I was just imagining things. Maybe it was my own voice I was hearing, a voice welling up from my unconscious. But what I'd heard sounded odd. Not an easy thing to do, now is it? Even unconsciously, I wouldn't talk to myself like that. I took a deep breath, and from my perch on the stool again, looked at the painting, focusing my attention on the work. It must have just been my imagination. Is it not obvious? Someone now said. The voice was right beside my ear. Obvious? I asked myself. What's so obvious? What you must discover, can you not see, is what it is about Mr. Manshiki that is not present here, someone said. As before, a clear voice, a voice with no echo, like it was recorded in an anechoic chamber. Each sound, clear as crystal, and like an embodied concept, it had no natural inflection. I looked around again. This time I got down from the stool and went to check in the living room. I checked every room, but nobody else was in the house. The only other creature there was the horned owl in the attic. The horned owl, of course, couldn't talk, and the front door was locked. First, the stool moving on its own, and now this weird voice. A voice from heaven? Or my own voice? Or the voice of some anonymous third party? Something was clearly wrong with my mind. Ever since I had started hearing that bell, I'd begun having doubts about whether my brain was functioning normally. With the bell, at least, Manshiki had been there and had heard the same sound, which proved that it wasn't an auditory hallucination. My hearing was working fine. Okay, so what could this mysterious voice be? I sat back down on the stool and looked at the painting. What you must discover, can you see, is what Mr. Manshiki has that is not here. Sounded like a riddle, like a wise bird deep in the forest showing lost children the way home. What Manshiki has that is not here, what could that be? It took a long time. The clock silently, regularly, ticked away the minutes. The pool of light from the small east-facing window silently shifted. Colorful, agile little birds flew onto the branches of a willow, gracefully searched for something, then flew away with a twitter. White clouds, like round slates, floated over the sky in a row. A single silver plane flew toward the sparkling sea, a four-engine propeller SDF plane, on anti-submarine patrol, keeping their ears and eyes sharp and watchful, making the latent manifest was their daily job. I listened as the engine drew closer and then flew away. And finally, a single fact struck me, literally as plain as day. Why had I forgotten this? What Manshiki had that my portrait of him did not, it was all clear to me now. His white hair. That beautiful white hair, as pure white as newly fallen snow. Manshiki without that white hair was unimaginable. How could I miss something that important? I leaped up from the stool, went to my paint box and gathered up the white paint, picked a brush and, without thinking, thickly, vigorously spread it on the canvas. I used a knife, too, even my fingertip at one point. For 15 minutes I painted, then stood back from the canvas, sat down on the stool, and checked out my work. And there, before me, was Menshiki the person. Without a doubt, he was in the painting now. His personality, no matter what that was made up of, was integrated, manifested in the painting. I had no handle on the person named Wataru Menshiki and knew barely a thing about him, but as an artist, I had captured him on canvas, as a synthesized image, as a single, indivisible package, alive and breathing within the painting. Even the riddles about him were present. Still, no matter how you looked at it, this was no portrait. I'd succeeded, at least I felt I had, in artistically bringing the presence of Wataru Menshiki into relief on canvas. But the goal wasn't to depict his outer appearance. That wasn't the goal at all. That was the big difference between this work and a portrait. What I'd created was, at heart, a painting I'd done for my own sake. I couldn't predict if Menshiki would accept this painting as his portrait. It might be light years away from the kind of painting he'd been expecting. He'd told me to paint it any way I liked, and didn't have any special requests about the style it was done in. But just possibly, there might be some element in the painting, something negative, that he himself didn't want to recognize. Not that I could do anything about that now. Whether he liked the painting or not, it was already out of my hands, beyond my will. Seated on the stool, I kept staring at the portrait for nearly another half hour. I had painted it, that much I knew, but the end product outstripped the bounds of any logic or understanding I possessed. How had I painted something like that? I couldn't even recall now. I stared dumbfounded at the painting, my feelings swinging from intimacy to total alienation. But one thing was sure, the colors and form were perfect. Maybe I was on the verge of finding an exit, I thought, finally able to pass through the thick wall that stood in my way. But still, things had only begun. I had only just managed to grasp a kind of clue as to how to proceed. I would have to be extremely careful. Telling myself this, I went over to the sink and methodically cleaned the paint from the brushes and painting knife. I washed my hands with oil and soap. Then I went to the kitchen and drank several glasses of water. I was parched. All well and good, but who had moved the stool in the studio? It had most definitely been moved. And who had spoken in my ear in that strange voice? I had clearly heard the voice. And who had suggested to me what was missing from the painting? A suggestion that had clearly been effective. In all likelihood, it was me. I'd done this myself. I'd unconsciously moved the stool and given myself the suggestion about how to proceed. In a strange roundabout way, I must have freely intertwined my conscious and subconscious. I couldn't think of any other explanation. Though, of course, this couldn't be the case. At 11, I was seated on a straight-backed chair, sipping hot tea and randomly mulling over things, when Menshiki's silver Jaguar drove up. I'd been so wrapped up in painting that the appointment we'd made the day before had completely slipped my mind, not to mention the auditory illusion or the voice I must have imagined. Menshiki? Why is he here? I'd really like to take a good look at the stone chamber again, if I could, Menshiki had said over the phone. As I listened to the now familiar growl of the V8 engine come to a halt, it all came back to me. Chapter 18. Curiosity didn't just kill the cat. I went outside to greet Manshiki. It was the first time I'd done so. I didn't have any particular reason, it just turned out that way. I wanted to get outside, stretch my legs, breathe some fresh air. Those round, slate-shaped clouds still floated in the sky. Lots of these clouds formed far off in the sea, then were slowly carried on the southwest wind, one by one, toward the mountains. Did those beautiful, perfect circles form naturally, not from any practical design? It was a mystery. For a meteorologist, maybe it was no mystery at all, but it was for me. Living on this mountaintop, I found myself attracted to all sorts of natural wonders. Manshiki had on a collared dark red sweater, light and elegant, and well-worn jeans, so light blue they looked ready to fade away. The jeans were straight leg, made of soft material. To me, and I might be overthinking things, he always seemed to intentionally wear colors that made his white hair stand out. This dark red sweater went very well with his white hair. His hair always was at just the right length. I had no idea how he kept it that way, but it was never any longer or shorter than it was right now.
"I'd like to go and look into the pit right away, if it's okay with you," Manshiki asked. "See if anything's changed."
"Okay by me," I said. I hadn't been back either in the woods since that day. I wanted to see how things were, too.
"Sorry to bother you, but could you bring me the bell?" Manshiki asked.
I went inside, took down the ancient bell from the studio shelf, and returned. Manshiki took a large flashlight from the trunk of his Jaguar and hung it from a strap around his neck. He set off for the woods, me tagging along. The woods seemed even a deeper color than before. In this season, every day brought changes to the mountains. Some trees were redder, others dyed a deeper yellow, and some stayed forever green. The combination was truly beautiful. Manshiki, though, didn't seem to care.
"I looked into the background of this land a little," he said while he walked. "Who owned it up till now? What it was used for? That sort of thing."
"Did you find out something?"
Manshiki shook his head. "No, next to nothing. I was expecting that it might have been some religious site, but according to what I found, that wasn't the case. I couldn't find out any background as to why there would be a small shrine and stone tumulus here. It was apparently just an ordinary piece of mountainous land. Then it was partly cleared and a house was built. Tomohiko Amada purchased the land along with the house in 1955. Prior to that, a politician had used it as a mountain retreat. You probably haven't heard of him, but he held a cabinet position back before the war. After the war, he essentially lived in retirement. I couldn't trace back who owned the place before that."
"It's a little strange that a politician would go to the trouble of having a vacation home in such a remote place."
"A lot of politicians had retreats here back then. Prince Fumimaro Konoe, Prime Minister just before World War II, had a summer retreat just a couple of mountains over from here. It's on the way to Hakone and Atami, and must have been a perfect spot for people to gather for secret talks. It's hard to keep it secret when VIPs get together in Tokyo."
We moved the thick boards that lay covering the hole.
"I'm going to go down inside," Manshiki said. "Would you wait for me?"
"I'll be here," I said. Manshiki climbed down the metal ladder the contractor had left for us. The ladder creaked a bit with each step. I watched him from above. When he got to the bottom, he took the flashlight from around his neck, switched it on, and carefully checked his surroundings. He rubbed the stone wall and pounded his fist against it.
"This wall is solidly made and pretty intricate," Manshiki said, looking up at me.
I don't think it's just some well that's been filled in halfway. If it was a well, it would just be a lot of stones piled up on top of each other. They wouldn't have done such a meticulous job. You think it was built for some other purpose? Manshiki shook his head, indicating that he had no idea. Anyway, the wall is made so you can't easily climb out. There aren't any spaces to get a foothold. The hole's less than 9 feet deep, but scrambling to the top wouldn't be an easy feat. You mean it was built that way? To be hard to climb up? Manshiki shook his head again. He didn't know. No clue. I'd like you to do something for me, Manshiki said. What would that be? Would it be an imposition for you to pull up the ladder and put the cover on tight so no light gets in? That left me speechless. It's okay, don't worry, Manshiki said. I'd like to experience what it's like to be shut up here, in the bottom of the dark pit, by myself. No plans to turn into a mummy yet, though. How long do you plan to be down there? When I want to get out, I'll ring the bell. When you hear the bell, take off the cover and lower down the ladder. If an hour passes without you hearing the bell, come and remove the cover. I don't plan to be down here over an hour. Please don't forget that I'm down here. If you did forget, I really would turn into a mummy. The mummy hunter becomes a mummy. Manshiki laughed. Exactly. There's no way I'll forget. But are you sure it's okay doing that? I'm curious. I'd like to try sitting for a while at the bottom of a dark pit. I'll give you the flashlight. And you can hand me the bell. He climbed halfway up the ladder and held out the flashlight for me. I took it and held out the bell. He took the bell and gave it a little shake. It rang out clearly. But if, just supposing, I were attacked by vicious hornets on the way and fell unconscious or even died, then you might never be able to get out of here. You never know what's going to happen in this world. Curiosity always involves risk. You can't satisfy your curiosity without accepting some risk. Curiosity didn't just kill the cat. I'll be back in an hour, I said. Watch out for the hornets, Manshiki said. And you take care down there in the dark. Manshiki didn't reply, and just looked up at me, as if trying to decipher some meaning in my expression as I gazed down at him. There was some kind of vagueness in his eyes, like he was straining to focus on my face but couldn't. It was an uncertain expression, not at all like him. Then, as if reconsidering things, he sat down on the ground and leaned against the curved stone wall. He looked up and raised his hand a little. All set, he was telling me. I yanked up the ladder, pulled the thick boards over so they completely covered up the hole, and set some heavy stones on top of that. A small amount of light might filter in through narrow cracks between the boards, though inside the hole should be dark enough. I thought about calling out to Manshiki from on top of the cover, but thought better of it. What he wanted was solitude and silence. I went back home, boiled water, and made tea. I sat on the sofa and picked up where I'd left off in a book. I couldn't focus on reading, though, since my ears were alert for the sound of the bell. Every 5 minutes I checked my watch and imagined Manshiki alone in the bottom of that dark hole. What an odd person, I thought. He uses his own money to hire a landscape contractor who uses heavy equipment to move that pile of stones and open up the entrance to that hole. And now Manshiki was confined there all by himself, or rather deliberately shut away in there at his own request. Whatever, I thought. Whatever necessity or intentions motivated it, assuming there was some kind of necessity or intention, That was Manchiki's problem, and I could leave it all up to him. I was an unthinking actor in someone else's plan. I gave up reading the book, lay down on the sofa, closed my eyes, but of course didn't fall asleep. This was no time to be sleeping. An hour passed, without the bell ringing. Or maybe I'd somehow missed the sound. Either way, it was time to get that cover off. I got up off the sofa, slipped on my shoes, and went outside and into the woods. I was a bit apprehensive that hornets or a wild boar might appear, but neither did. Just some tiny birds, Japanese white-eyes, flitted right past me. I walked through the woods and went around behind the shrine. I removed the heavy stones and took off just one of the boards. "Mr. Manchiki!" I called out into the gap. But there was no response. What I could see of the hole from the gap was pitch dark, and I couldn't make out his figure there. "Mr. Manchiki!" I called again, but again, no answer. I was getting worried. Maybe he'd vanished, like the mummy that should have been there had vanished. I knew it wasn't logically possible, but still I was seriously concerned. I quickly removed another board, and then another. Finally, the sunlight reached the bottom of the pit, and I could see Manchiki's outline seated there. "Mr. Manchiki, are you okay?" I asked, relieved. He looked up, as if finally coming to, and gave a small nod. He covered his face with his hands, as if the light was too bright. "I'm fine," he answered quietly. "I'd just like to stay here for a little longer. It'll take time for my eyes to adjust to the light." "It's been exactly an hour. If you'd like to stay there longer, I could put the cover on again." Manchiki shook his head. "No, this is enough. I'm okay now. I can't stay any longer here. It might be too dangerous."
"Too dangerous?"
"I'll explain later," Manchiki said. He stroked his face hard with both hands, as if rubbing something away from his skin. 5 minutes later, he slowly got to his feet and clambered up the metal ladder I'd let down. Once again at ground level, he brushed the dirt off his pants and looked up at the sky with narrowed eyes. The blue autumn sky was visible through the tree branches. For a long time, he gazed lovingly at the sky. We lined up the boards and covered the hole as before so no one would accidentally fall into it. Then we put the heavy stones on top. I memorized the position of the stones so I'd know if anyone moved them. The ladder we left inside the pit. "I didn't hear the bell," I said as we walked along. Manchiki shook his head. "I didn't shake it." That's all he said, so I didn't ask anything more. We walked out of the woods and headed home. Manchiki took the lead as we walked, and I followed behind. Without a word, he put the flashlight back in the trunk of the Jaguar. We then sat down in the living room and drank hot coffee. Manchiki still hadn't said a thing. He seemed preoccupied. Not that he wore a serious expression or anything, but his mind was clearly in a place far away, a place, no doubt, where only he was allowed to be. I didn't bother him and let him be, just like Dr. Watson used to do with Sherlock Holmes. During this time, I mentally went over my schedule. That evening, I had to drive down the mountain to teach my classes at the local Arts and Culture Center near Odawara Station. I'd look over paintings students had done and give them advice. This was the day when I had back-to-back children's and adults' classes. This was just about the only opportunity I had to see and speak with living people. Without those classes, I'd probably live like a hermit up here in the mountains, and if I went on living all alone, I'd likely start to lose my mind, just as Masahiko said. which is why I should have been thankful for the chance to come in contact with the real world. But, truth be told, I found it hard to feel that way. The people I met in the classroom were less living beings than mere shadows crossing my path. I smiled at each one of them, called them by name, and critiqued their paintings. No, critique isn't the right term. I just praised them. I'd find some good component to each painting. If there wasn't, I'd make up something, and praise them for a job well done. So I had a pretty good reputation as a teacher. According to the owner of the school, many of the students liked me. I hadn't expected that. I'd never once thought I was suited to teaching, but I didn't really care. It was all the same to me whether people liked me or didn't. I just wanted things to go smoothly in the classroom, without any hitches, so I could repay Masahiko for his kindness. I'm not saying every person felt like a shadow to me. I'd started seeing two of my students, and after starting a sexual relationship with me, the two women both dropped out of my art class. They must have found it awkward, and I did feel some responsibility for that. Tomorrow afternoon, I'd see the second girlfriend, the older married woman. We'd hold each other in bed and make love. So she was not just a passing shadow, but an actual presence with a three-dimensional body, or perhaps a passing shadow with a three-dimensional body. I couldn't decide which. Menshiki called my name, and I came back to the present with a start. I'd been completely lost in thought, too. "About the portrait," Menshiki said. I looked at him. His usual cool expression was back on his face. A handsome face, always calm and thoughtful, the kind that relaxed others.
"If you need me to pose for you, I wouldn't mind doing it now," he said. "Continue from where we left off, maybe? I'm always ready."
I looked at him for a while. Pose? It finally dawned on me. He was talking about the portrait. I looked down, took a sip of the coffee, which had cooled down, and after gathering my thoughts, put the cup back on the saucer. A small, dry clatter reached my ears. I looked up, faced Menshiki, and spoke. "I'm very sorry, but today I have to go teach at the Arts and Culture Center."
"Oh, that's right," Menshiki said.
He glanced at his watch.
"I'd totally forgotten. You teach art at the school near Odawara Station, don't you? Do you need to leave soon?"
"I'm okay, I still have time," I said. "And there's something I need to talk with you about."
"And what would that be?"
"Truthfully, the painting is already finished, in a sense." Menshiki frowned ever so slightly. He looked straight at me, as if checking out something deep inside my eyes.
"By painting, you mean my portrait?"
"Yes," I said.
"That's wonderful,"
Menshiki said. A slight smile came to his face.
"Really wonderful. But what did you mean by, in a sense?"
"It's hard to explain. I've never been good at explaining things."
"Take your time and tell it to me the way you'd like to," Menshiki said. "I'll sit here and listen."
I brought the fingers of both of my hands together on my lap. Silence descended as I chose my words, the kind of silence that makes you hear the passing of time. Time passed very slowly on top of the mountain. "I got the commission from you," I said, "and did the painting with you as model. But to tell the truth, it's not a portrait, no matter how you look at it. All I can say is, it's a work done with you as model. I can't say how much value it has as an artwork or as a commodity. All I know for sure is it's a work I had to paint. Beyond that, I'm clueless. Truthfully, I'm pretty confused. Until things become clearer to me, it might be best to keep the painting here and not give it to you. I'd like to return the advance you paid, and I am extremely sorry for having used so much of your valuable time. In what way is it not a portrait? Manshiki asked, choosing his words deliberately. Up till now, I've made my living as a professional portrait painter. Essentially, in portraits, you paint the subject the way he wishes to be portrayed. The subject is the client, and if he doesn't like the finished work, it's entirely possible he might tell you, "I'm not going to pay money for this." So I try not to depict any negative aspects of the person. I pick only the good aspects, emphasize those, and try to make the subject appear in as good a light as I can. In that sense, in most cases, it's hard to call portraits works of art. Someone like Rembrandt being the exception, of course, but in this case, I didn't think about you as I painted, but only about myself. To put it another way, I prioritized the ego of the artist, myself, over you, the subject.
Not a problem, Manshiki said, smiling. I'm actually happy to hear it. I told you I didn't have any requests, and wanted you to paint it any way you liked.
I know, I remember it well. What I'm concerned about is less how the painting turned out, and more about what I painted there. I put my own desires first, so much that I might have painted something I shouldn't have. That's what I'm worried about.
Manshiki observed my face for a time, and then spoke.
You might have painted something inside me that you shouldn't have. And you're worried about that. Do I have that right?
That's it, I said. Since all I thought of was myself, I loosened the restraints that should have been in place.
And maybe extracted something from inside you that I shouldn't have, I was about to say, but thought better of it. I kept those words inside.
Manshiki mulled over what I'd said.
Interesting, he finally said, sounding like he meant it. A very intriguing way of looking at things.
I was silent. I think my self-restraint is pretty strong, Manshiki said. I have a lot of self-control, I mean.
I know, I said. Manshiki lightly pressed his temple with his fingers and smiled.
So that painting is finished, you're saying? That portrait of me?
I nodded. I feel it's finished.
That's wonderful, Manshiki said. Can you show me the painting? After I've actually seen it, the two of us can discuss how to proceed. Does that sound all right?
Of course, I said. I led Manshiki to the studio. He stood about 6 feet in front of the easel, arms folded, and stared at the painting. There was the portrait that he'd posed for. No, less a portrait than what you might call an image that formed when a mass of paint hit the canvas. The white hair was a violent burst of pure white. At first glance, it didn't look like a face. What should be found in a face was hidden behind a mass of color. Yet beyond any doubt, the reality of Manshiki the person was present, or at least I thought so.
He stood there, unmoving, gazing at the painting for the longest time, literally not moving a muscle. I couldn't even tell if he was breathing or not.
I stood a little ways away by the window, observing him. I wondered how much time passed. It seemed almost forever. As he observed the painting, his face was totally devoid of expression. His eyes were glazed, flat, clouded, like a still puddle reflecting a cloudy sky. The eyes of someone who wanted to keep others at a distance. I couldn't guess what he might be thinking deep in his heart. Then, like when a magician claps his hands to bring a person out of a hypnotic spell, he stood up straight and trembled slightly. His expression returned, as did the light in his eyes, He slowly walked over to me, held out his right hand, and rested it on my shoulder.
"Amazing," he said.